sometimes four classes per quarter may be possible, but also very difficult to manage.
And if people listening to this or hearing this want to get involved, how could they do this in the movement that you're building?
There are a number of organizations that have begun to address the concerns of adjunct faculty. There's the New Faculty Majority. There's also Adjunct Action. We have been organizing on our campus with the Service Employees International Union, SEIU Local 925. So unionizing movements for adjunct faculty across the country are really gaining steam. I would encourage people to look at organizing on their own campuses, at joining some of the other groups
and
that support
Edgerly,
adjunct faculty.
As we wrap up, just to be clear, an adjunct professor is the full teacher of the class, not the assistant in a class.
That's correct. We have the same training, the same degrees, the same qualifications, and we teach in exactly the same classroom. Students are getting the best quality we can give them.
We're going to have to leave it there.
We're getting much less.
But I thank you for joining us, Louisa Edgerly, adjunct instructor at Seattle University, where she's joining other adjuncts and students and tenure-track professors today in a National Adjunct Walkout Day. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO is a proud sponsor with Runaway Productions of Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4, February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, 1507 Southeast 39th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Bad Habitat, Tope, Speaker Minds, Mike Crenshaw, Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27th, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4. Starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes. Swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Industrial streets, class lines, money talks, turning language to paper pieces, rich man's war, free man society, raging violent insecurity, nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act, rich man's war, Pershing's cruising Europe, America, Russia, governmental nuclear views. Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. Three Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war. The poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war. With machines for ancestors, new unborn generations, chemical umbilical cords are only wiring, and your electrical progress.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And that was John Trudell. Played that for the second time in a row. Played that last week as well. Yes, and this morning we have a guest, Cecily Saraski, who's in town. Where are you in town from, actually?
The Bay Area.
The Bay Area, not that far.
No.
Just like last week's guest, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. It's been quite a full week with a lot of great events around town, talking about some similar issues. And you're the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, a national 60-plus chapter grassroots organization which advocates for a U.S. foreign policy based on democracy, human rights, and equality in Israel-Palestine. Is that an accurate characterization? I hope so. It's on the program from last night.
Yes, it's the brief, it's the one-sentence version.
Well,
yes,
I hope you'll give us
a... I can
go
into it.
I'm sure you will. And yeah, that was quite an event last night. That really packed hall there at the Smith Ballroom, which is a big hall to begin with. It was a pretty high-energy event.
Yeah, it was actually really gratifying to see the framing of the issue, to have Indigenous peoples and Omar Barghouti, who's one of the leaders of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, and an honor to be on that panel and to have that conversation about how U.S. settler colonialism relates to Israel and Palestine and settler colonialism there and the commonality of those struggles. It's a very important conversation to have.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it really got a lot of people's minds geared maybe in a different direction. I'm fairly familiar with that way of framing stuff, but I certainly learned a lot last night as well. I'm sure a lot of people may not have been quite as familiar. Anyway, so the panelists were, as you said, Omar Barghouti, who's a Palestinian researcher, commentator, and human rights activist, and Kanahus Manuel, a woman warrior from the Sekwepemp Nation. It's a lot of consonants in there. not so easy for our English-speaking tongues. She's been active in fighting against development projects and corporations such as the Sun Peaks Ski Resort, Imperial Metals. Talked a lot about that just terrible mine disaster, the Imperial Mines tailings pond break about 8 months ago, which just devastated their salmon spawning areas, rivers. Showed us some video. And yourself and Dr. Michael Yellowbird, citizen of the three affiliated tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, professor of sociology and director of Indigenous Tribal Studies at North Dakota State University. And we did tape that for KBOO. Jenka Soderberg was there, so we will be bringing KBOO listeners that audio at some point in its entirety. And the kind of back and forth between North America, as you said, settler state issues, and Palestine was quite important. And I think that it really gave, you know, the whole idea, the framing of the, I've been thinking about this quite a lot, especially, you know, I've been thinking about it in the context of what's been going on with the Black Lives Matter movement, and with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz with her new book, Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States, the whole reframing of U.S. history, which is something that's been going on for quite a while, but sort of now coming back to the fore, it seems like, after the neocons kind of ruled the roost for a long time. Maybe there's some energy going, stronger energy going in the other direction. I certainly hope so, because we certainly need it.
Well, I think that our, you know, I think about my son who's 12 years old, and we've been at war in the Middle East virtually his entire life. He doesn't know anything else, and this particularly in the post 9/11 era. And so these kids are surrounded by a very similar discourse around which Michael Yellowbird addressed last night, this discourse of the savagery, in this case that savage other is the terrorist, is the Muslim domestically, and people in the Arab world. So we have a whole language justifying our wars and interventions in the Middle East, which, as we know, in many cases are really driven by frankly, greed and interest in oil and resources and so on and so forth. So I think that incredible escalation of that rhetoric in this period of time is just sort of a replay of the same language and the sort of founding moral justification where if it wasn't obvious to you before, it certainly is now, the sort of U.S. exceptionalism and that we are an empire and this sense that other people and brown-skinned people are absolutely there for us to bomb and kill and take their resources. I mean, that's always been true throughout our history, but I do think that our relationship to the Middle East has really escalated that framework.
And Dr. Michael Yellowbird's discussion of the film American Sniper was
yes,
really, really powerful.
And it's so interesting because I think about that because my son and his friends who come from a variety of community, different ethnic and racial communities, they all really wanted to see that film. And that was one of the few cases where the parents put the foot down. And I understood and knew enough about it and the level of dehumanization. But we work in the world of Israel-Palestine politics. We are very used to seeing the very, very darkest underbelly of incredible racism. In the language that people use to talk about Palestinians, it's quite breathtaking. So, and it's helpful for me, I think about racism as an ideology and language that gets created after the fact to justify whatever your various exploitative activities are. And so if you want free labor through slavery, you develop a whole language and framework around dehumanization and racism so that you can still maintain your self-image as a moral Christian good person and nation as we did. And so that's what we see happening all the time now.
So, you know, I was interested, Omar Barghouti's talk was, I mean, there was almost a optimistic, I mean, the idea that Netanyahu is just so over the top that he's basically the best recruiter for the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement that has really boomed in the last 2 years. Like, I guess he just didn't seem like he didn't foresee that happening. It seemed like it was somewhat unexpected, the growth of that movement.
Yeah, I don't know that Omar would say that it's unexpected, the growth, because but you're absolutely right. The escalation of it is kind of breathtaking. And people who long worked in the South Africa anti-apartheid movement say it took us way longer, you know, from the time those first divestment initiatives were even introduced. It's happening at a much faster pace. And you know, in our world, a lot of what we do as activists is the art of activist judo. In other words, there's so much over-the-top behavior and so much extreme behavior, both, and I should say, reflected domestically as well as in Israel and Palestine, that and Netanyahu is an example of that. That you just, as a good activist and building a movement, you want to be able to amplify they make clear how horrific the situation is, and they do a lot of the work for you. So he's absolutely right that that's been happening. And Israel domestically, people who care deeply about Israel should be deeply alarmed. What's happening, the lessening of human rights in the country, the lessening of democratic interests. But, you know, there are political leaders who are just very open. We don't have an interest in democracy, not the way that we understand it here.
Well, it's perhaps arguable about democracy here in the United States as well.
But. Well, indeed. And I recognize that fully. But relatively speaking, as Ed Omar and I were talking about that, he said, you know, we are deeply aware of all of the incredible faults and the ways this is not a representative country. But from his perspective, he said, I've been traveling in Europe. You guys have no idea how lucky, how good you have it relative to places. You know, in places like France, he said, that's the only place we've had BDS activists actually arrested for working on these campaigns. It's the only place
in
that
France?
And he said it's the only place that he's felt threats of violence. And, you know, Europe has a different tradition around libel laws. Their relationship to free speech doesn't look like ours, etc. So I thought that was an interesting perspective.
Hmm. Well, I would like to let people know that you can call in at 503-231-8187 with your questions and comments. And please try to keep them as brief as possible. And I'm speaking with Cecily Saraski, who is in town, spoke at PSU last night. I didn't give the name of the event. It was Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. And that was put on by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, a group at Portland State that's been very active since they formed. When was it? A couple years ago? I can't remember. Anyway, a bunch of co-sponsoring organizations, and you can all link to their information and Jewish Voice for Peace and other stuff we're going to mention on the page for this program, Wednesday Talk Radio, at our website, kboo.fm. And talk about how you got involved in this particular issue. Has this been something you've been doing for a long time?
Yeah, I have been, and I've been with Jewish Voice for Peace. What is interesting and is also hopeful in the context of such a painful situation is our organization started with a few people in a living room, and really after this summer, when we were the only major national Jewish organization to come out absolutely unequivocally against Israel's terrible, terrible onslaught of the people of Gaza, we became the fastest growing Jewish organization in the country. And it's so many people in our community were looking for a clear moral voice that said enough is enough, and what I want is equality and fairness with Palestinians, not what we have. And so the demand for that is growing exponentially. We're in fact overwhelmed. And my story is very similar to the stories of many people. We understand, we were talking a lot about decolonization last night and decolonizing our minds and the ways that we have internalized these ways of thinking. So many of us were raised with a sense of, well, first we believe that Israel was created in a place where there were no people. The famous Zionist slogan that we've all heard, a land with no people for people with no land. But of course, it was a land with people, just as the place where we are standing now was also a land with people. And so we were raised with that, and then we were later raised with the notion that Palestinians and terrorists were the same word. Not only did they not have any legitimate claims whatsoever, but that their only interest was an inherent hatred of the Jews. And so it takes a long time to unlearn those things. And often people unlearn things during periods of trauma. And so I had an experience of going on a trip to Israel. My uncle co-led a trip with the Jewish Federation. And they have these missions. And these missions are meant to bring people, particularly who are going to be donors, and they're very tightly engineered to give you this emotional experience of meaning and purpose, which we're all looking for in life. But they're also very, very tightly engineered propaganda trips. And I was on the airplane sitting next, and it's a long flight on LL Airlines. I'm in New York. I'm on my way. I'm very excited. I know something's off. This was, you know, 20 years ago. I know something's off, but I don't quite know what. At the time, this was not something you could study really on campuses. This was not a conversation topic. I mean, to see how far we've come is remarkable. But I also knew this was a place that my grandparents and many people like them who had suffered from pogroms, who had lost family in the Holocaust, that they had put all of their energy and hopes into this heaven on earth, this saving place. But I'm on this airplane. I'm sitting with a couple who are young and Israeli and absolutely delightful, and we're having a great time, and I'm just, this is so fun, and we're on the way to Tel Aviv. And then in the middle of that conversation, and the way I describe it, I was sitting next to the window, so there was really nowhere for me to go. In the middle of that conversation, this absolutely beautiful, delightful young Israeli couple started talking about, quote unquote, the Arabs. And the way they talked about them, I'm from South Philadelphia. I'm not a shrinking violet when it comes to racism. I grew up around all kinds of interesting things. But the way they started talking, it was like being in the 1950s in Mississippi and Bull Connor. I could not believe the dehumanizing way. I mean, I will not repeat what they said, but it was like being kicked in the stomach. It was worse. It was so extraordinary. It's like you're talking to a beautiful person and suddenly horrible, you know, like bugs and scorpions come out of their mouth. And there was nowhere for, I was so shocked by it, and there was nowhere for me to go. And I was so unprepared for it. And I didn't know what to say or do, but my body was shaking, and I felt a great amount of shame that I didn't know how to respond to it. But it was such an intense experience that when we landed, despite the fact that I was in a tightly engineered experience, all I saw, I said, I recognize this. This looks like racism to me. I recognize this. And this, what you were talking earlier about, there are linkages now between Black Lives Matter movement and the Palestine Liberation Movement, and groups like Dream Defenders who have gone, and they say, this looks familiar to me. I know this experience. We have Driving While Black or Driving While Brown. You have incredible incarceration rate of Palestinians without having to be tried, kept for arbitrary periods of time. There are so many that, you know, shootings that we have of Black and Brown people here by police. That's what you primarily have. The primary violence against Palestinians is state violence. So those things are familiar. So that, for me, changed everything. And when I saw it and felt it at the end of the trip, we all went around and said, how was your experience? And people talked about, wow, I have meaning and purpose. This is what I want to do, support Israel. And for me, I had kind of that breakdown. You know, when you have a breakup with your beloved and you wake up the next morning and you can't believe it's true and you're hyperventilating and you can't stop crying, that's literally what happened to me. And I couldn't stop crying and hyperventilating. They all thought something was wrong with me. And I kept thinking, I am so glad that my grandparents actually never, although they dedicated much of their life to building this state, they never had actually seen it. And they never had the money to travel and go there. And I kept thinking, I'm so glad they didn't, because this is not what they signed up for. And that story is similar to many people's stories.
But probably still, I mean, obviously things are changing, because it does seem like a younger generation of Jewish people is really getting it in a different way, and more in this way to your. So it seems like that attitude of that young couple is to some extent breaking down. And I'm sure you don't have like a percentages of how many people think what way, but that kind of hardcore, like really dehumanizing attitude is obviously still there, because that's what runs the whole way the military, the way the ruling parties deal politically. But I mean, how much time have you spent in Israel? Have you spent time since then in Israel?
Yeah, I have. And I've gone back on multiple occasions, uh-huh, and in the West Bank and Gaza several times as well. And I can tell, and we work very closely with people on the ground, and my colleague, the director of Jewish Voice for Peace, is there. Her husband and children are Israeli, so she spends quite a bit of time there. And after this our folks who we work closely with, the tiny fledgling human rights world and left in Israel among Jews, after this summer and this terrible, terrible onslaught on Gaza, they were saying that folks in that would joke, we're now all coming out as racists. In other words, something broke in the public discourse. And if there had been a thin membrane keeping people from openly talking about Palestinians, leaders, the highest level of leaders, obviously there's always been a language of talking about Palestinians and is as subhuman in some way. That's part of the very deeply ingrained all over the place. But it became, from the leadership level, absolutely open level of outright and vicious racism. And what's also it's built into the DNA of a country that has said, I mean, you have chosenness and you have this idea that some people are chosen and some aren't, and you have it built into the laws of the country where you have privileges to Jews that you don't give to non-Jews. And many people don't realize that nearly 25% of Israel population are not Jewish, and so about 20% of those people are from the early indigenous, you know, the Palestinians who lived there before Israel was even created, and so those people are systematically denied equal rights through the legal system of the country. So when the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is the incredible educational segregation. There are only about 5 or 6 schools that are not segregated. So even though you have 20% of the population, again, that's Palestinian, those students and the Jewish students are not going to school together. We hear this story over and over again from friends who are Jewish, who say, I was 18 before I even met anyone who was Palestinian. Imagine that, 20% of the population, and still that segregation system exists.
It almost seemed like that would be hard to do in a country so small.
Yeah, no, it's really quite an accomplishment, and there are all kinds of justifications for it. But the end result, everywhere you look, is a system that is designed to make people scared of each other. And so Israelis, as much as anyone else, are going to have to decolonize their own minds, just as we've had to do that in our country.
Well, we've got several callers who've been waiting very patiently. So let's go to our first caller. Sarah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Paul. I just wanted to call in and give a little bit more information about SUPER, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. The organizers of last night's event. So SUPER is a Portland State student group that's been around since 2008. It was founded during Operation Cast Lead, when the urgency of the death toll in Gaza called for some immediate action and some student organizing. And I got here in 2012, just before Pillar of Defense, the second really major bombing campaign against Gaza, started up. And I had recently been in the West Bank, but I was new to organizing for Palestine here in the U.S., and I was just launched into this all-hands-on-deck situation where we were calling for rallies and writing press releases. Then we saw just this past summer the third major bombing campaign, Israeli bombing campaign, launched against Gaza. So that's been some of the major work of SUPER. It came out of a direct response to that urgency of getting attention to what's happening in Palestine and the experience of Palestinians. We also do conferences and other kinds of events and host speaking tours, and we meet once a week at Portland State University, and anybody is welcome to join us. So check out our website or our Facebook. It's /PSUSUPER at Facebook. You can look us up or email us at super.info.pdx@gmail.com.
Great. And are you working with other student groups around the Portland area?
We do work with other student groups on campus at Portland State. So, for example, the event last night was co-sponsored by United Indian Students in Higher Education. That's acronym USHI. The divest Portland State fossil fuels divestment movement. They're also looking at university endowment holdings and collaborating with organizations like 350.org that look at city and state level investments. Who else do we work with? International socialist organizations, Students for Unity, Environmental Club. We are in touch with a number of organizations.
Great. Well, thank you much for calling in.
Yes, thank you.
And that was Sarah from the super group, Students United for Palestinians Equal Rights. And we'd have another caller. Tim, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for talking about this issue. I just wanted to plug a book and plug some people that are here in Portland. I think last year Allison Weir released a book called Against Our Better Judgment, and she talks about the history of the Zionist movement in the United States and talks about how far back it goes. It goes all the way back to like the 1880s. And it's a very short book, but it's like dynamite in terms of the information. In particular, the origin or the existence of this secret group called Purushim that Brandeis, the old Supreme Court justice, was a part of, and other Supreme Court justices were actually also members of this secret Zionist group. And also, I just want to draw attention also to some fabulous Palestinians that are here in Portland, including the husband of Jenka, the afternoon news director, Saeed, and Wada, and Holagoras, and all these other fabulous, brilliant Palestinians that are here in Portland that we really need to elevate to leadership. And then I guess I just kind of want to ask your guest what her perspective of the Zionist agenda for America is. What is the purpose of Netanyahu coming? I mean, we know it's to get us into a war with Iran, but, you know, what is the overall agenda of the hardcore Zionist groups towards America? That's my question.
All right. Thanks.
Well, I have a framework that you can't understand what this whole story without contextualizing it in terms of U.S. empire and U.S. interests. I know there are some folks that think that the U.S. might have a beneficent and kind and gentle foreign policy were it not for Zionist groups. I don't think that's true at all. I think we are an empire and we act thusly, and we are always looking to expand throughout the world and expand markets and take advantage of oil resources and control them and so on and so forth. So there is a relationship between the two and Zionist groups, and we talked about that. Literally, you know, when you look at the writings of Herzl and early the Zionist leaders, they very much made themselves available to colonial projects and said, this is win-win. You want to get rid of the Jews. You want to have designs over the Middle East. We're your people. We can do both. Give us our country. Clearly, I think when you read people like Avram Berg and folks who have been inside the highest levels of leadership in Israel, who have now sort of come out and talked about Palestinian rights, they say don't assume that people have a clear and agenda. He said they don't. Netanyahu, in many ways, it seems, is driven by his own egotism and his own narcissism and his own desire for political survival. We were talking about this the other night. So even the risk that the PA might collapse is actually a terrible thing for Israel and the security apparatus there. But Netanyahu seems to be pushing it. And as you may have heard in the last few days, Al Jazeera leaked information that Netanyahu Netanyahu's own people in the Mossad and in the security establishment contradicted his assessment of the Iranian threat in terms of developing nuclear capability. So there is so much disagreement just within the Israeli government and the and people in the military, people in security. So he's going to come again, try to bring us into war. He's going to try to distract us from the Israeli expansionism. He also really just wants to get elected. And so this is a huge ego boost for him. So I don't think we can, I wouldn't over project that he has a grand master plan beyond his own survival at this point.
Yeah, you know, the whole issue of getting elected, I don't know if it was on Democracy Now! Or somewhere else I heard recently, really got me thinking. The whole framework of these cycles of elections and the way certain personalities kind of rise to the top of the process and the fact that they have to continually campaign. Yeah, I think it was talking about how in Israel, even more than the U.S., they're always campaigning. So you get these characters who are, you know, they may not even represent, it's like it skews the entire society, the entire like political reality of a country, United States, Israel, anywhere. This it's really a strange form of making collective decisions, that you have these people who, you know, just in addition, leaving aside corporate money, although that like totally amps it up, but just the fact that they have to continually convince people and then convince themselves that like their whole rhetoric and their whole approach, they have to like exaggerate things. They have to like pander to a certain kind of constituency that might be completely different if it was a different, I don't know, am I making sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's actually really relevant to this because an article recently came out that said that most of Netanyahu's money is coming from American donors. So if you perceive this as actually a big donor visit, because again, there's been such outrage about his speech before Congress. One of the things that he has effectively done that our movement has never been able to do is it seems to be ending the bipartisan consensus in unconditional support of Israel. It is now becoming a Republican versus Democratic issue because clearly his invitation by House Speaker Boehner was meant to humiliate President Obama, humiliate the Democrats. And so now you have up to, right now it's almost 30 Democratic representatives who are skipping the speech. So even folks like Abraham Foxman from the ADL, who is predictably 100% pro-Israel, has said Netanyahu coming to speak here is a bad idea because for Israel's long-term interests, it's a bad idea to end that bipartisan consensus. But if you understand it in the context you just framed, which is this is in part a donor visit to him, this is where he's actually getting most of his money from, and that is his primary concern, elections, it makes sense.
Let me, before we go to our next caller, let me just, a couple of events coming up in Portland. I had mentioned Black Lives Matter. As we stand at the start of a new year and ever-growing momentum behind the Black Lives Matter movement, we see there are many possible roads forward. Please join Ferguson to PDX and an all-Black and African panel of activists and community organizers for a forum where we'll discuss what the future of the movement could look like. What does Black liberation look like? The Ferguson is Everywhere Forum will be held on March 1st, that's this Sunday, at 1 p.m. at SEIU Local 49, 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue here in Portland. Panelists include Ajamu Umi of the All-African People's Revolutionary Party of Portland, Adrian Kabue of Black Lives Matter Portland, Marcus Angel Cooper, Mike Crench, our own Mike Crenshaw, and Walida Imarisha. Child care will be available and children are encouraged to participate. Refreshments will be provided. That's this Sunday. Tonight at the PDX Green Dragon, let's celebrate our victory. We demanded and won a $15 fair wage policy for city contract workers, and we also won $15 for full-time permanent city workers. There's still much work to be done to ensure a $15 minimum wage for all workers in Portland and Oregon, but let's celebrate those victories when we win them. I'm speaking, obviously, from the point of view of the organizer of this, not my own. We're having celebratory volunteer appreciation night at the Green Dragon on Wednesday, February 25th at 6 p.m., our hardworking volunteers deserve a night of fun and relaxation. Come out and join us if you want to get to know your fellow 15 Now PDX activists, or if you want to get more involved, minors welcome. That's at 928 Southeast 9th Avenue, right at Belmont, I believe. So those are a couple of events coming up in Portland. And I am speaking with Cecily Saraski, the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, a national 60-plus chapter grassroots organization which advocates for U.S. foreign policy based on democracy, human rights, and equality in Israel-Palestine. And we haven't yet talked about, you know, your specific campaigns, what you're actually working on right now. But let's go to one more caller before we talk about that. Bob, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say to your guest in Jewish Voice for Peace, you do wonderful work, and I have your newsletter in front of me, and I'll send you in another donation. And also, I have in front of me the newsletter for United Palestinian Appeal, which is another good great group to donate to that you probably know about that builds hospitals and schools and stuff in the Gaza Strip and other places. But I wanted to make one quick comment and ask you a question. As you were talking about the history of the racism against Arab folks in Zionism in Israel, I have history books here at home where there's quotes from major, as you know, major Jewish leaders in the 40s and 30s that basically talk about transferring the Arab population and pushing them into the sea and so forth. So it goes really, really way back. But the question I wanted to ask was, there's something I'm ignorant about a little bit, is the refusal of soldiers to serve in the Gaza and other places in West Bank, and a famous Israeli general who came out and said, this is all wrong and it's destroying our wonderful state of Israel and it's racist, and his son is on tour. Could you talk a little bit about the movement within Israel, and I may have missed it, to fight back, and people that say, you know, this is not my democratic Israel, it's wrong. There's some really powerful voices there, and could you talk about that for a little bit? And thank you so much for your work.
You bet. Thank you. Yeah, and I just want to address quickly your comments also about the racism. One of the things that I talked about last night and really want to underscore is some of these early Zionists, what they did, like any oppressed people, like any colonized people, they absolutely internalized a lot of the same white supremacy that had been used against them, and they internalized those attitudes towards the Arab world, or the Orient, as they called it at the time. And you look at these writings, and in fact, I would say it's really important to make these distinctions and understand that you know, the only people they had as much disdain for as the indigenous Arab population were the indigenous Arab Jews. In other words, it didn't matter. They felt that they also were primitive Jews. There was a lot of language of disdain for Jews, both from the sort of, you know, dark, small, hunched over shtetl Jew, as they called it, who was religious and an embarrassment and sort of, you know, walked to the camps. But they also, many Jews of Arab countries, they also regard with similar disdain. So this is not about, it was an internalized racism that crossed all kinds of lines. Now,
that is really paradoxical. I mean, and I don't want to be insensitive, but you almost get this sort of strange reflection of like an Aryan kind of, I mean, well, it's a terrible thing to say. But.
No, see, I actually think it's really important to demystify that. Yes, you're right. I mean, there was this whole notion of the new Jew. There were lots of images of Jews who were blonde and blue-eyed and strong and muscular, et cetera, posed again against, you know, what people who looked more like me, who are darker and shorter And so that's true, but I don't think it's paradoxical at all. I mean, it is paradoxical, but I actually think it's really important to demystify that. Look, women are the agents of patriarchy all the time. You know, white supremacy has worked its way into black communities in all kinds of interesting ways and hierarchies around my skin is lighter, your skin is darker. Queer folks adopt homophobia, transphobia, heteronormativity. I mean, you could go on and on and on. We were hearing about that with indigenous communities and these councils that have been created where they were actually using sort of, you know, these indigenous councils to help pursue the policies of corporations.
Government created ones. Yeah.
You tell me any occupied, any colonized, any oppressed people, and we all struggle with this in our communities. And I don't think it's actually that different in that regard. It's not a Jewish thing; it's a human thing. And so that is very much the work when we talk about decolonizing ourselves that we have to do. I mean, if women said no to patriarchy, it would be over tomorrow. But women are many women are very much a part of those systems in all kinds of ways that seem to make no sense whatsoever. So I think that's true, but you can see it very, very vividly in that regard. And then regarding the refuser movement, I'm so glad the caller raised that. And we've been working with refusers for a long time. They're really remarkable stories. We work with a group called the Shministim, and every few years, and that means 12th grader, and these high school kids, these incredible high school kids, and the first one I believe was in 67, actually, a class of students will write a beautiful, beautiful statement of refusal to serve in the occupied territories. And they are, and the group we first got involved with, they, if you go to, I think, December18th.org, and you can watch a video of them. And these young kids were getting put in jail, in some cases solitary confinement, for doing it over and over again and for refusing. You actually have a situation. Yoni Ben Artzi, his uncle, his uncle is Bibi Netanyahu, and he served time in jail because he refused to drop bombs on Palestinians. And can you imagine that even here, the nephew or niece of the president of the United States? I mean, it's a small country, so you actually have pretty strong leftists in these families, ruling families. And so it's very, very inspiring to see folks, and there are numerous examples of people refusing, and the price they pay is quite extraordinary. Sometimes people just literally have to leave the country because they are considered such traitors. There's a video that just came out. Again, this actually goes to what we were talking about, ways this hatred is actually turned on other Jews. Human rights, anyone who's associated with human rights in Israel is considered a traitor right now. It's part of the public leadership discourse there. A video just came out, and you can go to Haaretz, one of the settler groups, and the way they portray Jewish human rights activists is literally looks like Nazi propaganda, literally. And the Haaretz piece talks about that. If you can imagine a dark Jewish man with a large nose and coins falling out of his pocket, and this video talks about human rights activists as being paid, because they are so greedy and motivated by that, they are being paid money to provide the rest of the world with reports on Israel's human rights violations. It's a very scary. So those refusers are quite brave. Quite brave.
So coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, we speak with Sharman Apt Russell about citizen science and her book Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. Call in with your questions about citizen science at the same number to call into this show, 503-231-8187. And as always, like to thank KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And we are speaking for the next 15 minutes left in this program with Cecily Saraski, Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace. And we hadn't yet gotten to current campaigns, what you're working on, but we will right after we hear from Jack, our next caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, that's very brave, the work that you're doing and your colleagues in Israel working to stand up to this. And there's you make it very clear. It's the Zionist movement is essentially a colonization movement. When you point out clearly that the indigenous Jewish population is treated no differently than the Palestinians, that it's a colonization movement, and we continually hear of the indigenous people characterized as terrorists, I think it's important to remember that in this current struggle, and it's not the first time. I don't know how much how you feel about the Old Testament, but when people settled this territory, there was a directive came down, supposedly from God, to expunge the land of Canaanites, and so there was the first time around, and now in this second time around, or maybe more than the second, but nevertheless, we have to remember in this struggle going back, the biggest, probably the biggest terrorist incident of the war to establish the Israeli state was the King David bombing. And that was Irgun, the predecessor of Mossad, and it was a heinous, a false flag terrorist event. And this has pretty much set the tone for the way this has gone. The Mossad, if people should look this up if they're not aware, the motto is, by deception, make war. And I think this is something that's important to remember, especially when we hear that the bombing of Gaza was justified by these rocket attacks. Do we really know who launches these rockets? Moreover, you have to remember that Hamas was funded and instigated and set up by Mossad. So these are important things to keep in mind, I think.
And I think everything you said is, and this is where we talk about it, really doing this work also puts up a mirror to the United States. All of these behaviors, all of these ways of operating, you know, blowback. You know, we supported the Mujahideen, which, you know, evolved in our proxy war with the Soviets and in Afghanistan, much as they supported, it's true, the Israeli government, and they supported the growth of Hamas as a response to sort of the growth of the Palestinian, the PLO, and so forth. So we are very connected. I think that's part of the issue, is to think it's you don't think of we are an empire and we work together, and when you look at the amount of the sort of mercenary way that the United States military and security acts around, really throughout the world, you understand how and why we have a special relationship. We have very similar approaches in that regard.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Jack. I just wanted to give you a chance again to talk about... Oh, Steve. Okay. That'll wake our listeners up. So, yeah, talk about some of the ongoing campaigns you're doing. You know, last night, obviously, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement is something that you're very involved in. You said you're got a lot of different. You're really growing. There's a local Portland chapter. What do local chapters do? What do they work on?
Yeah. So one of the things that's really important is every local community looks differently. Looks different, and so we really encourage work with chapters to power map their community and look at who has power, look at where those winnable campaigns are, what makes sense, who can they create alliances with. And in some cases, they may look around and decide, you know, the thing that makes the most sense here is working on G4. And that would be in the context of boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns, but it also is in the context of, you know, we have a movable institutional Jewish community here, and that's actually where our strength is. So we're going to start working with these synagogues or these institutions because that makes sense. Or we are in a campus community where there's a huge amount of intensity happening on campus. So we're going to provide a lot of support to the local Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. We're going to help them with, you know, or just be of support to them when they need us on divestment campaigns and so forth. So it looks really different in different places. And I'll give you an example. So in Durham, North Carolina, G4S is a group that does sort of private prisons and provides security in the occupied territories, but also all over the place here, including in Portland. And so in Durham, their contract was up for renewal by the county. And so our chapter led a campaign, but they worked in coalition with other human rights groups who are actually concerned not so much about what was happening in Palestine, but in the United States, that G4S contractors are highly militarizing its privatized police force and all the problems they were having. And they all worked together, created a coalition, lobbied, and were successful in getting the county to cancel that contract for the next year. So those are the kinds of winnable campaigns, coalition-based campaigns, that then, and when you have campaigns like this, you force a moral crisis. You raise an issue to the top where people have to have a conversation about it. You cannot avoid a conversation about it. And that's where change starts to happen. But nationally, we're also the other, we've just in the last few weeks, again, Portland was deeply involved in this. Again, we were talking about Netanyahu's speech before Congress. We think that this end of the bipartisan consensus is a really important moment. We have been encouraging and literally working with other groups, U.S. Campaign Day on the Occupation, American Muslims for Palestine. We are all working to get our constituents to encourage their legislators to skip that speech and boycott it. It is just, it is a shanda, as we say. It is a shame that he is speaking before Congress. And so we have people, we've been dropping off literally petitions, thousands of call-in days, petitions from constituents in dozens and dozens and dozens of congressional offices.
And apparently some of our Oregon representatives are sort of on the fence or planning to go to this
event? Yeah, I think the latest is they are still on the fence. So it is really important to call. I just spoke to one of our folks who walked through the halls of Congress the other day and said that staff people, particularly for the Dems, are actually pretty supportive of their employers skipping the speech. There's political pressure, and we have heard from legislators saying, I want to skip the speech, but I need to hear from my constituents to help me do that. And the leaders thus far, that most people who have committed to skipping that speech, including, by the way, the Vice President Biden, he says he will be out of the country, but I think it's fairly clear what's going on, include leaders of the Black Legislative Caucus, the Progressive Caucus, and the Latino Caucus.
And briefly talk, there's a big thing happened in California couple or 3 weeks ago, right? The California students decided to join the boycott, divestment, sanction?
Yeah, so the UC system in particular, the University of California system, has really been one of the pioneering place where many of these divestment initiatives have taken place. And what they have pushed for at UCLA and one, UC Berkeley finally, UC Davis, they have pushed for divestment from companies that profit from the Israeli occupation, which, by the way, is largely U.S. multinational companies, companies like Caterpillar or G4S, as we were talking about, or HP. And so the representative body of the student council actually voted to divest from companies that profit from numerous countries, not just profiting from human rights violations in Palestine, but a whole litany of countries, to have a consistent, consistent moral and ethical policy. But that's it. This is becoming an unstoppable movement. That is what is clear. It used to be very hard to get these through, but campuses, you raised this earlier, students are going to campus and you can now actually take classes and you can learn something other than watching Fox News. And it is politicizing people, and students working in Black student unions, Latino students, Iranian, Persian, you go on and on and on. All these coalitions are coming together and saying enough is enough.
Well, we do have one more caller. Maxine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I'd just like to give a little information about Jewish Voice for Peace locally here in Portland. If anyone's interested in getting involved in our work for the local Portland chapter, the email address is info@jvp-pdx.org. And we do have an active chapter. All the projects that Cecily mentioned are happening here in Portland, and including a BDS campaign, outreach to other anti-racism groups and the Muslim community, working with churches on divestment moves. And we just welcome everyone to get involved. And particularly this week, our two senators, Merkley and Wyden, need to get a lot of calls and emails and letters to urge them to skip Netanyahu's speech next week, and we're working on that as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Maxine, with a local chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, and that's, again, info@jvp-pdx.org to get more information about that. All right. And, well, we've only got a couple minutes, so you had mentioned that you wanted to talk about things that you didn't say in your speech last night. Is there one thing you'd like to leave us with? Or anything else?
Let's see. That is a great question. I just think that this is a really extraordinary moment in this movement. We see a quickening happening all over that and a coming together. I'd say one of the most important things, and Maxine just mentioned this, is domestically there's been, as we know, post 9/11, an escalation of the demonization, dehumanization of Muslims in particular, and police surveillance, and in the worst case, you know, killings and attacks on mosques and so on and so forth. And that we see that as a really important part of our work, that our struggle against anti-Jewish hatred has in many ways been hijacked and deliberately used. We all know the overuse of the term anti-Semitism to describe people who are simply critical of Israeli policies. Those of us who are Jewish and who actually care deeply about anti-Jewish hatred really have an interest in ending the misuse. But we also feel very strongly about standing by our Muslim allies here in the United States. And that's deeply important work to understand how this issue is actually feeding racism inside of this country.
So is there a way people can get a hold of your group nationally?
Yes. So you go to the website. It's jvp.org or jewishvoiceforpeace.org and sign up on our list. You can find all the local chapters listed there. You can see the campaigns we're doing, but definitely get on our list.
And this apartheid, Israeli apartheid week is coming up. When is that going to be?
It's in later March or now. I think it's in March, and it happens at slightly different times all over the world, actually. But there will be events at campuses everywhere.
That's something we didn't get a chance to talk about, the apartheid in Israel, more than just a metaphor, but maybe for another show. Thank you so much, Cecily Saraski.
You bet. Thank you so much.
All right. And this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio.
3 Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast, Rich Man's War, the poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich Man's War, attacking human, attacking being, attacking
earth. As citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KBOO is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning.